Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week I'm talking to Sylvie Simmons about her book, I'm Your Man, The Life of Leonard Cohen. And I was about to tell her that I was at the Carnegie Hall concert when they brought back all of these people who everyone thought was dead from the 60s folk scene, including Leonard Cohen, and I think it was the basis for the film A Mighty Wind. And even at the time, I thought it was very dangerous having a Leonard Cohen concert in Carnegie Hall, because there's all those balconies for people to jump off. And what I'd like Sylvie to do is to explain how someone who seems so compulsively depressive should have caught the hearts and minds of the 60s generation.
I remember you well in the Chelsea Hotel. You were talking so brave and so sweet, giving me.
Well, I guess because he was so depressive, we needed somebody to kind of ground us in a way, you know. But more seriously, he's a very deep thinker. And yes, there was an awful lot of drugs and sex and other things going on in that hippie era. And Leonard Cohen, I should add, doesn't associate himself with the hippies at all. He thought it was a very lax movement.
He did the drugs and the sex and the rock and roll, though, didn't he?
Yeah, but, you know, I think that his thing is that he was very deep. And I think one of the things that people were attracted to was that somebody who sounded like they had answers to things, even if they were very mysterious and strange answers. It was a time when people were looking for answers.
He was one of the, I mean, he sought answers in some strange places, Japanese monks, Scientology. He became a pre-clear, a dubious benefit. I hope he was a celebrity so they didn't charge him for this. And he dabbled in quite a lot of occult seeking after knowledge type stuff, didn't he?
Yeah, you know, I think it was a bit beyond dabbled. I don't think that Leonard's got like a dabbling vein in his body. I mean, he did try lots of different spiritual paths, but he always took them really, really seriously. With Scientology, he wasn't in it for long, but during that time he did go clear. You know, the song, famous Blue Raincoat, has the line, "Did you ever go clear?" And in his archives, I found a certificate showing that he did. In other words, he'd done enough of the courses of auditing to have, you know, qualified, or whatever you would call it, to be an operating thetan. He got out very quickly because they started using his new, very vague celebrity. It wasn't a huge celebrity at that point as a singer-songwriter, and turned his back on it and found other different paths. But yes, he took them very, very seriously with his Japanese Buddhism, his Rinzai Zen. He actually went and lived in the monastery for 5 years. And when that didn't really work out for him, even though he's still very close with his guru, he went to Mumbai and studied with a core Vedanta Hindu guru. So these are ongoing throughout his life, and he's also retained his Jewishness the whole time. He's still a studying and practicing Jew.
And I think he dabbled in Kabbalah as well, didn't he?
Well, again, it's studied, you know. I
studied, okay, dabbled. I'm a born again cynic.
But it's not like, I mean, if Madonna's doing Kabbalah, that's dabbling. I mean, he's not wearing the little kind of, you know, the string around his wrist and kind of using it as some kind of strange esoteric, you know, kind of what would Buddha do now kind of thing. He's serious about studies, and his rabbi was telling me about the kind of the great deep studies, conversations rather, he had with Leonard on the Kabbalah.
Well, it doesn't seem to have done much to lighten his soul, does it? I mean, he still comes over as pretty unremittingly gloomy.
Well, you know, I think he hasn't since 1988, when he released the album I'm Your Man, you know, when he started being overtly a comic. There was always some humour in his songs, but it was hard to find in the early ones. It was a very dark sense of humour. I think, you know, the British used to relate to it very well, because we had a sort of similar gallows humour, I think, to his. But as you know, as it kind of came on, he started being more overt in his humour. And when I talked to a lot of his childhood friends, they said, yeah, he was depressive, but he wasn't a whiny, moany, groany kind of depressive. There's some who maybe might think that his early songs had a kind of slightly whiny quality, but I'm amongst those who actually loved them, and so really just saw them as being kind of very deep and in many ways very, very moving.
I suppose saturnine is an adjective that sort of comes to mind almost. He wanders around radiating saturninity.
I haven't heard saturninity in a long word time, and I think that's a great word to use. Use it any time you want to. But yes, I think, you know, that there is that sort of quality to him, you know. And in the beginning, his words were harsh. You know, Leonard suffered for almost his entire life very deeply from depression. As he put it, not the blues. I would get up every morning, he said, wondering, what do I do to get through this day? I mean, it was serious. It wasn't just, I'm feeling down, you know. It wasn't that kind of, you know, little cloud over his head as he walked along. It was serious. And so, you know, when people were laughing about him giving away free razor blades with his albums in the early days, to him, he probably thought, well, that doesn't sound such a bad idea, you know.
didn't his mother tell him, it wasn't his maternal Jewish mother's advice to go and shave whenever he was nervous?
I know, you shouldn't have him around razor blades, but it's amazing. When you think about it, you know, the song Dress Rehearsal Rag, which was the first song, which was obviously about suicide, and he wrote it very early. He wrote it for the first album, but didn't record it at that point. And that was, yes, hey, Prince, you need a shave. And he's got the, you know, trembling hands, he's holding the razor blade. Yeah, it was something that is a very, very important strand of Lennon's life and work, is this, you know, this almost desire to extinguish himself and get rid of the pain, but at the same time working through it and coming up in the process with a remarkable body of work.
I mean, there's nothing in his life circumstances that he wasn't brought up in poverty.
You're cutting out at this point. Oh, your microphone, I can't hear you. It sounds like a cell phone that's kind of going boop, boop, boop. So if you could repeat anything, please.
I was saying there's nothing in his life circumstances has really sort of led him to depression. He was never at risk of life or poor or sort of cast out from his family or anything like that, was he?
There isn't anything in Lennon's life that would point to that, but other than the fact that I found out from a cousin of his that his mother, Lennon's mother, was hospitalized with depression, so there seems to have been some kind of at least genetic tendency towards a serious depression. But sometimes people just come out the egg that way. I'm sure you've come across children who've got absolutely delightful, you know, kind of circumstances in their life, but they're the little ones that are sitting there kind of drawing pictures of hangmen and painting everything black. So it's partly Lennon's disposition. It can also possibly go back to a big sense of loss that must have happened when he was 9 years old and his father died, leaving him to be brought up in a house of women by his mother, and his older sister helped out a little in that too. So who knows what actually causes depression in somebody. But he was both blessed and cursed. He came from a well-to-do family, family of high status, and they didn't want for money. You know, they had a chauffeur, they had a maid and a nurse. But he was also cursed with a kind of restlessness and a need to try and be empty and then be empty, but also fill that emptiness.
But he made this strange transition from being an avant-garde literary figure, a poet and novelist, into a pop star, and managed to, in fact, to combine the roles rather than abandon the older one. Of course, this means he got attacked from both sides, didn't it?
Well, you know, it's a kind of odd thing. He was and is a poet. All he did was, instead of kind of, as he said before, writing his poetry with music behind them, which was implied in everything he did, and that came about mostly because his great poet love, you know, his main hero, if you want to put it that way, was the poet Lorca, Federico Garcia Lorca, who also kind of wrote songs, or rather wrote poems called songs and ballads, and was a great lover of music and flamenco music, as Leonard was. He kind of always had this implied music in his poetry. It's interesting you said avant-garde. He actually wasn't an avant-garde poet. He was considered a very kind of almost orthodox traditional poet, but a great lyric poet. He used pretty much the old forms for his poetry and was loved for that in Canada and was very much the golden boy of Canadian poetry. But he was certainly an avant-garde writer when it came to novels. You know, Beautiful Losers, his second novel in particular, was a very strange and experimental work that got some in quite polarized reviews. He really just decided to get into being a songwriter. He didn't think of being a singer at the time, to make some money, because he wasn't making enough as a kind of poet to live. I'm sure you imagine that selling books in Canada is not going to make you a fortune.
Say it ain't so.
He would actually use his traditional, because he had sort of traditional verse, he thought, I can write kind of maybe country songs or something, maybe get a couple of covers and make a little more money, and I can live in my simple little house on a Greek island where he was living and get on with stuff without having to join the family firms and go that kind of way with his life.
Your tome is pushing 600 words. There's a lot here. He had a full life, but what strikes me is it's very much a chronicle. It tells you everything he was doing, who he was meeting, what he was doing. But you haven't really tried to first speculate or delve into his psyche in any deep way, have you?
Well, I take a little offence at that, to be quite honest.
Go on then.
Close reading will show that there is some input into his life there. There has been some analysis in there, and there's certainly a lot of contextualization of just this, the different eras and movements and people that he moved among. But really, the core thing to Leonard is to understand that really everything that he has done from the day that he put a notebook in his pocket as a child and started writing, everything is in the service of his work.
To disagree, by all means, please, that's what we're here for. My point was, you've taken the chronicler approach in the sense that you have you minutely detailed his life and the people he's interacted with and what their thoughts were about it. But I sometimes wonder, maybe you weren't allowed for copyright to quote his own more of his own work at the time, which might have been revelatory about what was going on inside behind that saturnine countenance.
Well, as you said, it's a very long book, and it could have been even longer. I mean, there was a point in the 3 years that it took me to write it when it almost was becoming like Winston Churchill, the war years. I mean, yeah. It could have been so many volumes of book, but you know, to keep it in that space, there comes a point when you cannot write about every song or about every particular piece of work. There's a lot in there, and yes, I had to pay the fees for all of these things that were quoted, so yes, I know that I did quote an awful lot, trust me, that's in there. But what
just to let readers know that you had to pay copyright fees on all of the citations in there.
Well, you know, this is maybe one of the things that people don't know about writing is that, you know, when you quote anything, you have to get permission to quote it. Generally speaking, that permission is given. Sometimes it's given for free, but when it's things that's already appeared in another book, or it's poetry, or specifically if it's sung, and you know a publishing company owns the rights to that, then you have to get written permissions to use all these things. It's probably one reason why some biographies don't have an awful lot of quoting of words in there, because they, in the end, they would get probably pay more to quote the words.
Ironically, of course, the lead case on this was the Scientologists, his former chums, who battened down on every biography of L. Ron Hubbard by suing every quotation from L. Ron Hubbard proving what a geek he was.
Well, this is it. I mean, so there is this thing going on, but that wasn't an issue with my book. I did not take out anything. The only thing I took out was actually one quote from a Lorca poem because of various conditions that Lorca's estate wanted and that I couldn't meet, so I didn't use that in there. But that's just technical stuff. It's really, you know, what's in there is basically what I thought was in there to give the fullest version of Leonard Cohen's story of his life and work, and the two are pretty much fused as I could in 600 almost pages, you know, without it becoming such a huge book that people would break their back carrying it out of the store. You talk about people with walk-on parts in his life being included in there. The reasons, everybody is in there for a reason, and a lot of people are not in there for other reasons. It's like pretty much every chapter of his life, I don't mean every chapter of his book, but every part of his life, to me, I spoke to people who I thought had insights into that. So some of those people were only there for a short time, but their insights are incredibly important to that particular time, which had its own importance and led to some work. So yes, there are a couple of Leonard Cohen's muses, if you like, or girlfriends of the night, and they have had short relationships with him, but they had great insights in one case into his Scientology study, or another case into his life in Montreal. So there's a reason for them being there. It's not because, oh, look, I managed to find a couple of girls who slept with him. Trust me, I could have spoken to
a few more pages, you think.
You know, it's like hands up if you haven't, almost at some places. So, you know, they were there for that reason. And so people who, you know, I wouldn't dismiss them as walk-on parts. I mean, I spoke to, you know, monks, I spoke to rabbis, these people who knew him, and also, let's say, his poetry editor. It was really interesting to me to have insights into how he put together something, and what, because a lot of his poetry was written at times when those poetry editors are no longer alive, you know. Leonard was born in 1934, so I was interviewing, for example, a rabbi who taught Leonard's bar mitzvah class. You can imagine how old that rabbi is when Leonard's 78 years old.
You almost need a Ouija board to interview people.
Also chosen very carefully for a reason, you know, to give this kind of, a little kind of help along the way into a path into understanding Leonard's life and his motivations.
So was he a cooperative biography or was he an absentee biography?
He was supportive. That was his word. He always seems to be very careful with his words, and supportive was the word that he used when I approached people to ask to speak to them. Again, with biographies, if you read a biography that seems a little bit poor and you wonder why somebody's talking to so-and-so and not somebody else, it's often because that's the only people they can get. Leonard Cohen did not behave that way. He granted me access to anybody I wanted to speak to. He didn't tell me who to speak to, but when those people, as they invariably do, called him and asked permission, that permission was given. And he also gave me permission to go through his personal archives and gave me photographs from his childhood. He didn't offer them. I asked if I could use them, and he said yes. And as far as I know, he hasn't read the book, or he certainly didn't read it before publication. And we did a couple of interviews. At the end of the process, we spent 2 days together, two separate days, just for kind of answering some questions that had come up in my mind after speaking to other people. The thing about an authorized biography, and this isn't an authorized biography, is they can sometimes be a little neutered, you know.
Reverential.
It's not so much even that. It's more neutered because, you know, nobody wants the bad parts of their life put in there. And if they're given a chance to, they'll probably try and leave them out. But Leonard Cohen had no interest in whitewashing. He said that to me. I don't want to whitewash. It just turned out that the more I investigated him, he seemed like a very good, decent man. You know, I didn't find any horrendous skeletons in the closet. You know, there were a couple of people who might have issues with him, but, you know, generally speaking, he came across to me as a person you'd want them to be. If you like their music and, you know, you've always admired them as an artist, sometimes if you start delving into an article, even as a music journalist or interviewing somebody, you come out thinking, oh, I wish I hadn't spoken to them. You know, this is not the person I would like them to be, you know. There are difficult people on this planet who are great artists, but Leonard appears to be a very good man who's a great artist.
Oh, obviously. And did you appreciate him more at the end than at the beginning, or as a fan?
Because, you know, I think I did, because I remember sitting down with him in December, and which was our last interview before, you know, the book went through all of its processes of being edited and, you know, put completely finished, and writing the epilogue and everything. And I sat down to him and I said, you know, these last 3 years, it's been exhausting being you, you know, trying to follow your life and follow your footsteps, you know, all your worrying, all your depression, all your hard work, you know. And he was very sweet, kind of gave one of those quiet Leonard Cohen smiles and did the equivalent of like patting my hand and said, yes, yes, I know, but I don't live in that reality now. It's kind of, he's not a kind of sentimental man and goes back and thinks about that stuff, you know. But it's true. I mean, by the end of it, I thought for him to have stayed as true to his art as he has through his life, you know, took an awful struggle. You know, the man was constantly struggling until recent years when, you know, his depression finally lifted in old age. And even then he had to deal with the theft of all of his money and go back on the road again after 15 years and, you know, mortgage his house at the age of 70 and try and get himself back on his feet again.
And that was one of the points. I mean, he seems to have been classically ripped off by the producers, the managers, the producer-style managers, doesn't he? He's a...
I know, as he said it, oh, his mum used to say, you know, it's almost like the oldest story in showbiz, you know, be careful, they're not like us, those people. And yes, he has lost an awful lot over the years, but, you know, he's wearing it very lightly. When I saw him just recently at the first date of the US tour in Austin, on stage he seemed lighter than ever, and backstage he looked younger than he was a year ago.
Well, I was going to come back onto the rejuvenating experience of going on tour. There was an early incident in his classics, Suzanne, wasn't it? He discovered that somehow he had lost the rights to it. How did that happen?
Well, that was in the beginning, in the early days, which was the story of that one was that his then manager who was a woman called Mary Martin, a very, you know, well-known woman in the music business, had introduced him to somebody else who was an arranger. And somehow or other, the papers were signed that this guy sort of somehow became the owner of the song. This happened quite a lot back in the old days, is what I've heard, you know, that managers somehow, you know, had a way of, or not so much the manager, but somebody else involved would have a way of sort of getting you to sign all sorts of stuff. And you have to remember back then that Leonard didn't really have an awful lot of power. I mean, he had a cover of his song by Judy Collins that was doing well, but he wasn't a big celebrity. And, you know, back then, I mean, I'm probably sure you have too, signed some dreadful contracts in my time, you know, because you just trust what's put in front of you. But this was a kind of, this most recent kind of purloining of his funds was a much larger scale, you know, it was a huge scale, and was probably the hardest part of the book to actually write, because it involved, you know, pouring through endless legal papers and such an unpleasant story.
Putting up your faith in bankers and managers, I suppose.
Well, in a way, you've got to kind of trust people. And this woman who was his manager was a very long-time friend. She had been the sort of secretary-executive assistant of his late manager. This was a previous manager, his second manager, Marty Machat. She had taken over when Marty Machat died in 1988, when Leonard's album I'm Your Man came out, and he was about to go on tour. He needed somebody. So this woman had been in his life for an awful long time. And when a person is that close to you and, you know, knows you really well and was at one point a lover, and, you know, her parents also worked for the company, and at some point you've got to put your trust in someone. And Leonard gave her financial power of attorney when he was in the monastery living as a monk for 5 years. And he also gave her medical power of attorney. So if anything happened, she would have to carry out his final wishes. So the trust was very deep. And so I think that when it turned out that she did not deserve that trust, it must have been a huge blow to him as a person, as well as to his bank accounts.
Yes, I suppose the natural reaction would be to get very depressed. But if you already are, what can you do? You go on tour.
Well, at that time, actually, it was thankfully at the time when he had actually gotten through depression. When he'd lived as a monk on Mount Bordy, everybody thought that when he came back down from the monastery after 5 years as an ordained monk, that he came back because he had cured his depression by the discipline of living up there all that time. But it was quite the opposite. He told me he left because he was too depressed to stay there. And he ended up going to Mumbai and studying with a Hindu guru called Vedanta, and it seemed to be a combination of studies with this man and also with Roshi, his Rinzai Zen master, that finally lifted the veil of depression when he reached old age. So the depression had gone, and I think that was one of the reasons he managed to deal with such a blow of being so royally ripped off and having to be forced back on the road after 15 years. He didn't like touring, so it was a very, very hard job for him to get back out there, not knowing at that time, believe it or not, that he had an audience. He thought he wouldn't have anybody there. After the remarkable 2008-10 tour, it seems almost like false modesty, but he truly did not know he had an audience. And instead he was greeted with this wave of love on, which has been buoyed ever since. And I think it's done, you know, remarkable things to him. You know, I mean, to have that happen at the end, towards the end of your life, I won't say at the end of your life, but in the later years of your life, you know, in your 70s, to be out there and just be adored in countries, especially like the US, where he generally was a little kind of underappreciated compared with Europe.
Well, that's something I wanted to come back to. I mean, how do you account for the disparity that, you know, he was a chart topper in Britain and not so bad in Canada, but on occasions almost invisible in the United States, which, you know, in some ways is the spiritual home of all of this stuff.
I know, it's really remarkable considering that he chose to live in the US. I mean, one of the kind of grand ironic stories in the book is that, you know, the story of his song Alleluia, which has been covered by over 300 people now, and everybody knows this song. You know, it's probably the most famous he did, but it was on an album called Various Positions that his American record record company wouldn't release because they said there's no songs on it. So, you know, that he really was underappreciated in the US. How to account for it? It's hard to say. I mean, you know, why are Europeans European is really what it comes down to. Why are the British the British? There's probably a darker sense of humor in most of the European countries that adored him. And if it wasn't because of the sense of humor, it might just be because of the sound of his voice, that kind of, you know, the French adored his voice because he could quite easily have been a Frenchman, you know, especially nowadays with that deep muttering, almost speak singing.
Was he actually bilingual from Montreal? Or
no,
he was brought up before, wasn't he, really?
He wasn't. He spoke French pretty much, but he, you know, like, you know, kids born in Britain in the 50s and 60s, we kind of, you know, we learnt French at school. It was a compulsory subject, so we've got a certain, you know, idea of French, but we can't speak it very well. And he was like that. He had a fair idea of it. But the French schools and the English-speaking school children were kept separate, you know, mostly because the Jews were lumped in, as he said, with the Protestants, or his best friend said. The Jews and the Protestants were thrown together on the grounds that they weren't Catholic and they didn't speak French. And so the French had their own school system. They didn't mix at all, you know. They didn't really see each other. And so he didn't really get... But he wasn't raised bilingually, but he certainly is, you know, can speak some French.
Yes, Montreal is a fascinating place.
Yes, I love it. I think it's fantastic.
Well, it seems to have come back to life, but without you. But I don't remember seeing any statues to Leonard Cohen. You know, it's not like Liverpool naming John Lennon International Airport after one of its favourite sons.
That's a good point. You know, it's funny you should say that because really he is, you know, almost like they're sort of, you know, their national hero up there. Maybe they carry him so much in their hearts that they don't need to put him in statue form, or maybe they're fed up because he moved down to LA and spends a lot of his time down there.
Or maybe he wasn't francophone in the city. Maybe he wasn't a francophone in the city authorities. Well, only honor of francophone.
There could well be that, but yes, I mean, he's much loved up there, and it was so delightful spending time up there researching for the book. I, you know, had a great, though their weather's a little bit a little tough on the system in winter.
You have to pick your time very carefully to go to Montreal, yeah.
Yeah, but I think somehow, you know, I think that's a winter actually is part of the character of Leonard. When he goes back to Montreal, he actually likes going up there in winter, not summer.
Well, you get fly bitten, and it's frost bitten in winter and fly bitten in summer, as I remember.
Oh, there you go. That's what it was like on Mount Baldy, the monastery where he lived. It was snowy in winter. They have to dig through the snow when you get up at 3 a.m. for the first meditation. And I went up there in the summer, and I was bitten half to death by gnats, so... It seems like it's you know, he's
been chosen to Montreal in the mountains. So we have an audience out there. Will people who is your book going to attract people who don't know who Leonard Cohen is?
Well, I can only go on reviews of this, you know, because it's one of those things that when you're the author, you're too deep in it. And, you, of course, you hope it will. But quite a lot of the reviews have said that even if it's, you know, you don't like Leonard Cohen, just the story itself is so remarkable that it's almost like reading a novel. And it's true that as I was writing it, sometimes it took on that kind of quality. It was like, no, this couldn't have happened. You're making this up, you know. And then I would do the research and get two or three different sources that would confirm it was true. And it would be true. So yes, this is a sort of somebody's life that went through all of these different eras, you know, that he went through. I think would be remarkable to anybody, really. I mean, I love it because it's, you know, got so much about his music and his poetry and his novels in there as well. But just his life is fascinating. This guy, you know, born into this kind of wealthy, high-status Jewish family in Montreal, who pretty much goes around the world from then on in all these different pursuits of, you know, wine, women, and song, and religion.
and smoking substances.
An unmade bed for the limousine, wait in the street. Those were the reasons, and that was New York. I was running for the money and the flesh. I was running for the money and the flesh. That was called love for the workers in song, and it still is for those of us left. Ah, but you. sweet lips.